La radio.
Ladies and gentlemen,
do not be alarmed, remain calm.
Welcome.
Do not attempt to leave the dance floor.
Music.
Super progressive. What is good, everybody? We are back another week, another artist interview, and legend alert. We have a total legend in the house for this week's episode. You know, whether I've been talking to Dave Seaman, Steve Perry, Anthony Papa, Luke Chabel, this guest is a name that has been on Super Progressive's radar for a while. I think he's calling in from Australia. I'm not sure where he is, but yeah. I know he represents Australia. We have Jamie Stevens on Super Progressive this week. Welcome, bro.
Hey, Jamie. How are you, man?
I'm very well. I'm honored to be asked to be here, for sure. Yeah.
Well, it's an honor for us, I'm pretty sure. It's very cool to have you in the channel. So, Jamie, you're having a fantastic year. We're talking a little bit about that. Mm. So, usually what we do, what Will and I do when we do these interviews is we like to get like the whole backstory, right? Because it's just not only talking about, okay, we're going to talk a lot about music, but we're incredibly interested in your life. Like, where did this passion come from? And how did you get technical-wise into all of this? And all of that good stuff that I know and we all know that all our super progressive community loves. So it's mm-hmm. all for the people, for your fans, of course. So
okay, well, how many hours do you have?
Yeah. How many hours do we have? Well, what I'll do, you know, Jamie, to allow you to really dive into these stories, what I'm going to do is. There's a really good interview with you that came out just 1 year ago. And I forget which channel which was, but I'm going to link it because it provides so much additional backstory to your story that, you know, even if we don't go in that same direction, I just want to make sure our viewers get to see it. So that's going to be in the description too. But so that means
was that the Canadian interview?
Yeah. So yeah. We can get into the specifics because I want to hear the stories, bro. So I guess where we can start is this. We can go back to your influences in a second, but we were talking about this slightly before the show started. But in that interview, I learned your music career, meaning you creating music. In that interview, it said it began in 1994. Now, for me, 1994, a super special year. I was born. I'm stoked on that. But more importantly, 1994, you have things happening in the world of underground music. Renaissance, the mix compilation comes out in 1994. All of this stuff is kind of getting into motion. When you're making music in 1994, what are you being influenced by down in Australia?
Yeah. Well, 1994 was the year that Infusion formed. So obviously I was making music before then, all the way up to that point. But that's when I formed, you know, the band with the four of us at that time. So around that time, I mean, leading up to that point, it was a massive influence on what we did as Infusion. So when I was going to university in the early 90s, it was like the music that really resonated with me as far as like a progressive sense. We had like Gorilla Records and Limbo. And that kind of sound just really, really touched me. It was something about that. And then you just mentioned the first Renaissance mix. And that was when I heard what could happen when DJs put together this music in a really incredible way. I wasn't really kind of going out that much back then. I went to a few raves here and there, a few club nights, but back in 94, not really a hell of a lot and definitely not really much where I was hearing this stuff. But around 94, 95, I started, you know, really going out a lot to these parties that these guys are Phil Smart and this guy Sugar Ray used to put on these nights called Sabotage, and that kind of mid-90s thing was, they were playing that kind of progressive sound, but mixed with all these other kind of genres as well. And so around that time, like, what made the sound so special was it was all kind of fresh and new. So there weren't really kind of walls set up between genres. So you would hear, you know, some breakbeat was coming through. You would hear some old style Chicago house. You'd hear all kinds, you know, the remixes of pop were coming out, you know, like the flute remixes of Bjork or something like that. So you had this kind of big melting pot of all kinds of sounds. So for me, that was really, really exciting. And I guess when we started the idea of Infusion, it was heavily influenced, like the style of playing was heavily influenced by Underworld and Orbital, in the way that we would just jam. Like there was no arrangement set. It was just you'd make up some loops and some things to play with, a couple of synths, and you would just jam. And so that kind of excitement of just making stuff up as you went along was the basis of what Infusion was. And I remember thinking at the time, like, why more electronic artists didn't work like that? Because, you know, when you're in the studio and you're messing around with equipment and you're just making stuff up as you go along, why couldn't you do that live? I mean, thinking back on it now, it's because it's bloody hard to do back then. Like, with so much work went into, you know, and equipment would fail, and that's why. Nowadays with Ableton, it's much, much, much easier to do that kind of stuff. But when you got, you know, we had these little Alesis MMT8 MIDI things, and then we'd show up at a gig and turn it on and pray that the data was still in there. There was actually one time we played in Sydney, this is when we were still living in Wollongong, which is like an hour and a half south of Sydney. Also, and I went up with my sister with all our equipment in the back of the car, and we got to the venue and we turned everything on and none of the data was there, and I forgot to bring the backup. So I had to drive back down to Wollongong, get the backup, drive back up. Yeah, we were pretty
good. Did you guys make it in time?
I'm sure Orbital never did that. just in general, it's just a pretty exciting time for music, really. Like, there seemed to be this, like I said before, like a melting pot of different styles, and just everything was happening so fast, I think. You know, people are trying different things, and there was no real, like, wasn't really a sense of, oh, that's that type of music, that's that type of music. It wasn't, you know, someone, you know, I mean, you look at the bands around then, like the electronic acts, like I said, Orbital, Underworld, Chemical Brothers. No one really said, oh, well, yeah, but it's got a 4-4 kick on it. So it's, yeah, but now this is syncopated. So that's a different band. And like, it wasn't really seen as, electronic
acts. But at that time, everything was like fusion, right? Because it all came kind of like from dance and pop. And the basis was house, but it really, like you said, they didn't have like an identity per se, because there was just like the four big ones, like techno, house, trance was starting per se. So everything was kind of mixed.
Yeah. And it's funny, like around then when you're saying that trance was coming up, and there was that sound of Platypus just coming through. You had, mid-90s, that was probably, Platypus and that kind of thing. Yeah. And you had the kind of hardcore rave sound there as well. And it's funny because you look at the music reviews in something like DJ Mag, and they had the genres of the reviews of their different releases. And some of them just didn't really make a lot of sense when you go to, when you go to listen to it, okay, that's interesting. And there's a lot of crossover there. But interestingly enough, like I used to get a lot of inspiration from reading the reviews and not listening to what they're talking about. And you'd read the description of the tracker. That sounds like a great idea.
Let's make that idea, but let's make it.
it keeps it so original. Yeah, that's awesome.
But you know what the truth is? Even nowadays, like all these blends, they don't really fit in what the music has transformed into, because now there's so many different sounds fusioned into everything. And I thought that when I began playing these type of tracks and playing in fusion per se was amazing.
I think DJs had a much broader range to kind of draw from, and the crowds weren't so, let's say this, like people didn't expect to go, okay, well, I'm going to hear exactly this type of music, anything that deviates.
It was more like a surprise,
You went to hear fresh music for a particular type of demographic, though. I mean, I think you still had your pure house heads, you know, they'd go down and hear, you know, listen to their, all their, you know, their funk DJs or all that. But I guess any time that I kind of felt that kind of brought, when that kind of mentality came back, I think was when, it was a playgroup and the Electro Clash thing just after that, where the indie sound, like Soul Wax and all that kind of stuff, that kind of, you people started colliding all these things together by taking sounds of like New York 70s bands and electronica. And that's when that kind of, that excitement of bringing a whole load of different sounds together kind of came back for me. I found that was pretty exciting. You know, it wasn't so until there. I like that.
I have a question about the formation of Infusion, because I'm learning like a lot about Infusion in real time. So who did you create Infusion with? And when you met the people that you would do Infusion with, or the person you would do Infusion with?
Yep.
Was it a feeling of like, oh my gosh, there's someone else there out there who wants to make this same kind of weird underground music as me? Or was this music more popular in your circles and it was what everybody was doing?
The former. Like I, growing up in Wollongong, as I said before, there wasn't really this music around at all. Even though it's close to Sydney, I never really kind of went out in Sydney. So this is before I went to university, like, you know, the music I was listening to, like, in high school, I was massively into my art classes. Art was my thing. And we would each bring along a cassette of music to listen to during class. And everyone would bring along, you know, typical kind of, you know, pop, rock kind of stuff. And I brought in a tape of Jean-Michel Jarre's Oxygen. And I remember everyone in the class going, what the fuck is this? What is this? I'm like, and I was like, going, just listen to it. Just you know.
Open your mind. I'm
like, this is weird. Like, oh, okay. Yeah. But so for me, electronic sounds weren't, I didn't really hear anything about that. And obviously it's before the internet and didn't know who else was listening to this stuff. But the most I'd kind of connect to it outside of my own experience was like reading magazines and, you know, keyboard magazines about how this stuff was made. And that was about it. And then I met, so it's around high school that I met Manny, who became one of my best friends. I met him in high school in English class, and we started making music together pretty much like a couple of weeks after we met. We'd have like sleepovers and get the four track out. He had this like Yamaha Porter sound. I had my little SH-101, and he'd make up little demo songs. All kind of, this is around the time that we were pretty obsessed with Depeche Mode and
like most of us.
Yeah, exactly. For me, it was Depeche Mode, New Order, and The Cure. They were the ones.
That was like the Holy Trinity, of course.
I always called it, I used to call it the Holy Trinity. Yeah, because I came from a background of just being obsessed with sound and the emotion of the music rather than song lyrics. So I wasn't really listening to pop. It was just all, you know, soundtracks and classical music and electronica. Like for me, I just wanted to kind of immerse myself in those worlds. And it wasn't until I got older that I started discovering bands like Depeche Mode and New Order and The Cure via a friend of mine, or friend of the families who I went to that interview that you mentioned before, Will, that no other people want to listen to that. But basically, this guy lent me all this vinyl, and I used to listen to this stuff like obsessively. And each week he'd give me another crate to listen to. So I discovered all these other bands, as well as from reading things like NME. You know, I'd read reviews, and I think that's how I discovered Underworld, actually. Their first album was, I think it was an NME review of it. I remember rushing to the store. It sounds great. That's another story. So that's when I kind of found that bands like Depeche Mode, they had this soundscape that they worked with. It was so interesting to me. It was exciting, and I thought the lyrics were amazing, and it had this melancholic vibe that really kind of suited my emo kind of personality back when I was a teenager. I think it kind of really kind of spoke to me. So that's when I started listening to I guess pop electronica, I guess, and then discovering all the remixes, all the Francois Kevorkian stuff, which, yeah, just incredible stuff. Then discovered like Pet Shop Boys and all the 12-inch remixes. But even before that though, my sister, my older sister, was a big fan of bands like Duran Duran. And so she listened to a lot of that sort of neuromantic stuff. And for me, the 12 inches were really interesting. And when I was listening to these songs, I just hone in on the things that's not a guitar. That's not a bass. What is that sound? And some of the studio tricks of just when they kind of go on the desk and like threw things around the mix and stuff, that's the stuff that really kind of excited me. I didn't know
like
how
the technical side of it, like the synths in the background and all the soundscape of it, like the whole technical side. Yeah.
Just what it did to your listening experience. It took you somewhere else. It wasn't just, okay, you know, that's a guitar, that's a singer. You know, I mean, I must say, like, since then, I've grown a massive, you know, new appreciation for singer songwriter stuff. Like, that's incredible. But back then, it was what could be done with sound and where it took you. For me, it was a very cerebral experience. You know, well, we're talking about, you know, obviously being pretty obsessed with Star Wars. The sounds that we, you know, the idea of taking you somewhere else with sound and music, I think, being a big science fiction fan, I think that the worlds that you could create that didn't exist before, that's the stuff that made me pretty obsessed with trying to do that myself.
It sounded like you were such like a musically advanced adolescent. How were you able to relate with anybody about your like deep fascination with music, bro?
Yeah, it's so funny. I haven't really thought about that. No, I in my household when I was growing up, my mum and dad like had music on all the time, and they used to listen to a pretty broad range of music. You know, my dad was very much into his 50s and 60s music. Mum loved her disco and African music and we had classical music going on. But just felt, yeah, then, you know, we had our pop stuff and all. You know, it was just everything. So even though a lot of it I didn't really kind of connect to at the time, I was still exposed to a broad range of music. But yeah, there was it was a pretty, I wouldn't say insular experience, but it was, yeah, it was something that I was pretty obsessed with and got in my own little hole, I guess, without really kind of thinking about it until now. I was pretty obsessed with it and still am, but now I can share it with other people, which is great. but yeah, I guess my friend Manny was the other person that I shared this with as a teenager. We used to go record shopping all the time together. We go scouring through the back pages of NME to find the rare remixes of Depeche Mode. Have you ever seen these old NME magazines?
No, I haven't seen the magazines, not, right. but I've been pretty in touch with the old remixes. That's amazing.
So pre-internet, you'd have these pages, and the print was tiny. And you'd have like the names of these bands and then the list of all the numbers of the remixes that were coming out or that have come out. And it was all the tiniest print. And they'd be like, yeah, when Enjoy the Silence came out and there were like 40 different remixes of it or something, or, you know, and you'd find all the special editions and you'd go through it. Oh my God, what's that? And you'd go to this record shop that we found in Sydney and we'd go through with our list and try and find stuff and, you know, scour through. And that was pretty exciting. That was kind of what got me, you know, I got really excited about discovering new music all the time. So it was about looking at the back of the releases and looking at the credits and looking at the equipment used and what studio they were in and who were the assistant engineers, and then using that as a jumping point to find other music that other people were involved with, which, you know, now, I mean, it's much, much easier to kind of find music that is connected to the music you're listening to now. Like people with their, you know, Spotify playlists or, you know, YouTube channels, whether it's, you know, which is great, because God, it could have saved me months and months of hunting for the music that I was pretty obsessed with finding. It was much, much harder. But there was also that, you know, I mean, I'm sure you speak to any DJ who will agree that some of the excitement was the chase of finding this stuff.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Finding that sound that resonated through every place and through all the audiences in the world. But the thing is that at that point in life, it was pretty much impossible to really get in touch with that kind of music. You had to really dig for it. It wasn't as easy as... I think that people really take that for granted today. Like, you have no idea how difficult it was to get those tracks and those things that you loved.
It's absolutely like the opposite thing right now, because now it's like, at least for me, it's like, it's not searching, it's parsing through. It's like you're drowning in everything that's like thrown to you, and you have to like try and find something legitimate and significant to you, where it's the other side of the spectrum.
You are so right. You're so right. It's definitely more like wading through everything now. Like before, it's like, yeah. You had your own kind of journey, and you do your own research, and maybe some people still have that kind of mentality. You know, I'm sure there's probably people who still do that. But you're right. It's a very, very different process of discovering music now, for sure. I mean, back then, I mean, there's labels that really kind of helped, I guess, broaden my musical horizons in a sense, because they were quite diverse labels. You know, like, say, if we're talking about Depeche Mode, like Mute Recordings, or Mute Records, you know, on that same label, you had like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, you had, Erasure. I can never pronounce their name. Oystanton Newbouton. You know,
I don't know that one.
Oystanton Newbouton. They're, you know, basically a German noise, the kind of band, industrial kind of stuff. You had all kinds of different artists. So back then, I mean, obviously, and when you're at that age, you're pretty thirsty for everything. But I would kind of go listen to all these kind of different types of music, even though it wasn't really sounding like Depeche Mode or anything like that. So again, that kind of, you know, in Creation Recordings, you know, Creation
Records, didn't they break Oasis? They signed Oasis first. Are we talking about the same Creation?
I don't know.
Alan McGee ran it.
That's it. Yeah.
So sick. I'm an Oasis super fan. So I like Creation a lot. Yeah.
Did you share that with Luke Chobel?
I don't even know if we touched on that. I mean, it probably came up, but is he a huge fan?
Luke's a massive Oasis fan.
Yeah. Makes sense. Why I like Luke so much. That's But no, yeah, Creation Records. That's cool.
Creation, yeah. Yeah. And they kind of did that crossover of that Manchester band remixed electronica stuff as well. So yeah, from that, you know, there's lots of Andy Weatherall stuff on Creation. They kind of had that, chill out. Well, it wasn't really called chill out back then. I guess Kayla called that album chill out. I guess the orb kind of stuff. But a lot of band, like the sort of the indie band side of
so you identified the sound,
Benny Ram,
you got more experience looking at labels, following that kind of magazine, so that will really focus you in that, and that's what really generated like the interest in Infusion for, okay, let's go to this route.
Yeah, yeah, this absolutely.
Is what we have to do.
Absolutely, and that crossover using vocals. Although in the start we didn't really use that many vocals actually. That was actually a bit later, to be honest. But yeah, it was for us. It was just seeing, you know, it was that kind of mentality of just seeing what happened in the moment. That excitement of being in that environment in front of a crowd and creating something new and exciting. Just, I guess, it was part of that zeitgeist of that you know, anything's possible, I think.
So I have a question, Ruben. Maybe you can help me with this timeline. But how did it go from you and Manny jamming and hanging out all the time at the record shop to, from what I've researched, international DJs playing your records all around the world? Like, when did that start happening for you? And when that started happening for you, what was it like in your head?
Okay, well, I guess it started because when I was going to university, I found out about this collective called Clan Analog. And that's when I found that there were people making electronic music as well. I was like, oh my God, it's not just overseas. Like, this is pretty amazing. So basically you'd have these, you know, synth geeks all kind of meet up and share synth stories and cassettes of their recordings and stuff. So that was Clan Analog, and I released a couple of tracks on my own I wasn't under my own name, it was under the name Oceania. And there's a couple of 12 inches that were released there. And through that, I found that there's a guy that became part of Clan Analog that I found out also lived in Wollongong. His name is Ben Askins. And so I said to him, hey, you should come over for a jam. And he came over, he brought his synth along, and we jammed for a couple of hours. I went, wow, this is great. We should do something about this. And that's when I said, look, I contacted Manny and said, look, I just had this jam with this guy, Ben. I reckon we should do something together. We should just, you know, have a band where we just jam. He said, yep, great. Because Manny's very musically proficient. Like he's amazing. Like he can play anything. He's, you know, just musically, he knows exactly what's what. I'm not. I'm just self-taught. So I thought he'd be great to kind of, you know, have as part of this. Yeah. And then later on, the guy that I was saying before gave me those loads of 12 inches to listen to. Years later, he opened up a store in Sydney, selling music equipment and repairing synths and so forth. And I had to take something to get repaired. And whilst I was in there, this guy, Frank, was in the shop and he was doing almost like scratching and, yeah, he's playing with the turntables and stuff, and thought it was really awesome. And he's like doing it to all this great music. So I got to talking to him and found out that we're into the same kind of music, and And at the time, I thought, it'd be really cool to have someone like her do some turntable stuff whilst we're playing as well. So Frank joined with that kind of a bit of that mentality and just kind of just putting that in the melting pot as well. For a while there was four of us. And then a while later, Ben left. He didn't want to do it anymore. He got another job. And so he left it. So it was just the three of us, just Manny, myself and Frank. So that was about 96 or so. And then we played. So early, about a year earlier than that, we got seen by this DJ who's quite big here at the time, this rave DJ called Pee Wee Ferris. And he said, you should come to my studio and record something. So I went there and we recorded some music, and his brother, John Ferris, works at Sony. And so he gave him the DAT of our music, and they ended up releasing two singles, which was a track called Green, which is a big rave track. And the first one was Smoke Screen, which is this slow breakbeat kind of thing. And it was during those sessions, because we used to play a lot of raves, not many clubs at that time at all. It was all, and we just noticed that the music was getting harder and harder. Like the hardcore thing was getting hard. And we started going out to these, like I was saying before, these sabotage parties, which were housier and more progressive house. And the tempo is much slower. I'm like, this is really cool. We want to kind of be a bit more part of this. So we started going to those events, and we started playing those events as well. And that was, 96, 97. And that's when we met up with the people that were part of a label called Thunk Recordings. So Phil Smart, who ran those sabotage parties with Ray, was part of Thunk Recordings, and along with this guy called Brett Mitchell. And so with them is this guy called Pocket as well, and a few of these other Sydney producers. And so we released some 12 inches on Thunk. One was Spike, which we did a remix of called the Morse Mix. And that was the one that really, really took off. That was really big for us. We found out that, it got played by, Sasha, Tim Amas, and like Paul Oakenfold. There's a whole range of people, which is really awesome. Which is actually that's an interesting one, because when we were doing that, so the original version of that is actually a slow breakbeat track, and they had this melody. It was like kind of this kind of film noir mystery kind of sounding theme. So I thought, it'd be great to have like a spoken word in here. But I couldn't find anything that worked. So I wrote my own. I wrote some dialogue that sounded like it was from a film. And Frank worked at a radio station at the time and got this voiceover guy, this great voice to say these words. And so we used that recording. And so I don't know if you know this track, it goes, as the rain comes down. And so we in that Morse mix, we pretty much just use all snippets of that dialogue. Anyway, so that was, those 12 inches did really, really well. And I was shocked to find out that, the DJs that I looked up to were playing our music. That was pretty shocking.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. Very cool. And then we released our first album called Phrases and Numbers. And that was on Thunk Recordings as well. And that did well. That was actually, it got picked up by a label in Japan, and that actually became pretty big in Japan, as the saying goes. And so that paved the way to later on when we started playing over there. But then to late 90s, early 2000s, we were playing a lot of those sabotage parties. We started playing things called this big festival here, used to be called Big Day Out. They had a place called The Boiler Room, where you'd have like The Prodigy and Chemical Brothers, and all these people would come out to play, and we played on those stages, and that helped us play to a much bigger audience around Australia, because so Big Day Out is it's pretty rare to have a festival like this where they'd get all these acts and they travel from city to city over the course of a couple of weeks. So you did Gold Coast, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide and Perth, which is pretty awesome. I don't know of any other festivals that kind of do that. So it's quite a...
That's the first time I've heard it. That's pretty cool.
Great experience. So that was very, very big in Australian culture. The Big Day Out was in January, you knew you were going to go to Big Day Out. Because we'd also have, that was in the Boiler Room was one stage, the electronic stage. They did that so, so well. And it opened up a lot of eyes to Australian audiences to hear a lot of this electronica club-based music. Because the main draw cards were all their rock bands. So, you'd have, name the band that played there. Like Nirvana played there in the early days. And, you'd have Iggy Pop and Nine Inch Nails played. You had Neil Young and just everyone. So you'd have all these thousands of people, but they'd also go in the Boiler Room as well and hear this other type of music, which is really amazing.
Very, very cool.
Actually, my mum and dad, they're big supporters of what I do. And anytime I do Sydney gigs, they'd come along to them if it wasn't too late.
Nice. That's awesome.
So Big Day Out was being a daytime event. They'd come along. And I remember...
they're like raving there with you. Thanks.
Yeah, they love it. They love it. And my mum listened to... she came along and saw Basement Jacks there.
Nice.
It's her thing. You know, this kind of Latin influence stuff. She's like,
They have a pretty cool sound. Yeah, that was very cool.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, such a good beat.
That's awesome. I just brought my dad... Or my dad brought me to a thing that I wanted to go to. It was in Liverpool. He came to come see Hernan Catania with me and Steve Perry for that big gig in Liverpool. But he was grooving with it too. I was so stoked. I was like, this is my world. We're not crazy. Everyone's super nice. I'm in good hands. Like, don't be worried. It's been so much fun to show him what this is really all about.
That's awesome.
So he'll be raving with everyone.
Yeah. Well, when I was going to university, when you go to uni, you can get this thing called Austudy, where the government gives you money to study, and it's to help you, live while you study. But most people spend it on records. I didn't spend all of it on records, but a vast majority. And so I'd come home. From uni, it was like a 2-hour train ride there and back. And I'd go with the 12 inches. I'd get home and I put them on my decks at home. And back then, I wasn't really DJing. I just bought the music. And that's the other kind of funny thing. I was always producing the music, and I just bought the 12 inches because I loved the music. I never bought them with a view to DJing them. I just built a collection because it's the only place you could buy the music. Yeah, to hear the music, you didn't have MP3s or anything like that. So,
and learning the process also, making
absolutely.
The tracks DJ friendly and all these things. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That would have made a big impact. And so I put these tracks on, and I just had a bedroom downstairs, and mum would come downstairs. Oh, what's this? I really like this. They're called Chemical Brothers. I like this. It's got a good beat.
So your mum is all about the groove, man.
Well, she's the one that used to listen to disco. And
she's all about the groove.
Yeah, yeah. In African music and stuff. Yeah. So that's where that came from, I think. Hey,
I wanted to ask you, were you guys the ones that did that? Because it always said, like the white label said, Infusion Running Up the Hill. Did you guys do that? Okay. I just got to know because I played that track like my whole life.
Yeah. So, Cass?
Cass and Slide?
Yeah.
I haven't spoken with him yet, but I know of him, obviously.
So, yeah. Awesome, awesome man. And we met and got on super, super well when we were in the UK. And he said, when I was back in Australia, he said he wanted to work on some music. And so I helped him with some music in the studio in the downtime. He said, so what else are you working on? And, you know, give me some, you know, play me some ideas that you've got. And I said, well, there's this remix I really want to do of Running Up That Hill, but I don't know what to do with it. Basically, for years and years and years, I had this loop because it's one of those songs that when I heard, when it came out, like, this is one of those songs that even though I was into pop music, there was something about this song that really grabbed me and like got in my heart and I just never let go. And back then, technology was so bad. I had a sampler that had 1.5 seconds of sampling time. So a lot you can do with that. So the technology just wasn't there yet to remix, really, for what I wanted to do with it. So, yeah. So later on, as time went on, I had these loops that I took out of the track. And so I had these loops, but I didn't know what to do with them. Like I had these sections. Well, that's one idea. That's another idea. That's another idea. I don't know what. So I played these to Cass. I said, oh.
Okay, so it's his connection.
Okay, go from this section.
Okay.
And then go to this section.
Wait. Sorry, Jamie. We just heard. It just cut out like 10 seconds. Oh. It just cut out. You were talking about, you said Cass, and then it went frozen. Yeah. Okay. I'll edit it. Don't worry. It'll be flawless.
Yeah. So Cass said, yeah. So he said, so we can go from one section to the next to the next. Mm-hmm. Just use all the sections. Oh, okay. So we sat there that afternoon just putting the sections together. And I was like, oh, how are we going to get from that part to that part? He said, just crossfade them. So that's why that bit where it kind of just changes and kind of gets a bit chaotic and then it comes in with a bass change. That was from one idea to the next idea. It was like, okay, so we did that.
It makes amazing transitions. That's the beauty of that. Yeah.
So it was just myself. That's why the mix isn't so good on it because it was just that afternoon, right? So that was, maybe I've kind of finished the next day or something. That was about it. And so he took that recording. He said, I can get some acetates done of it. And we can, he said, let's come up with the 8 or so DJs we could give them to. So he said, okay. So Sasha, Digweed, Tanaglia, Oakenfold, Tong, a few others. That was it. That's all we're going to send it to. And that was it. So somehow someone got the recording and pressed loads of copies.
No way.
Are you serious? Yeah. That was it.
Like someone snuck off with a copy and just like,
yep.
Clone yep. style, and printed and a million units.
One of the most common stories in those white labels at that time.
This is the white label mentality.
And that re-space just lining everything up is just amazing. All the downbeats and the percussion, I just love it. I still play it. It's amazing. Everybody just and the fact that last year, like Stranger Things, just
so lit,
yeah,
exploded with that track. It just played beautifully.
I actually got so many messages when that happened.
Said, oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Re-release it. Do something with it. Put it back out there. Make it available. I think there's a lot of Running Up That Hill around right now. I don't think anyone needs any more.
No, but you know what happened? A lot of guys started making your remix in a more modern way. Just like adding a little bit of maybe some transients just to give it some air in the top, because you know that the old music didn't have like that 14.
Oh no, it's a really badly mixed track. Yeah. Right? So Dave Dresden actually pointed that out quite a few times, going, dude, it's such a bad mix. But yeah, I know.
I love it.
It's one afternoon.
It's rough, so but it captures an energy, you know? It's rough.
Yeah,
amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Thank
amazing
you. Track. Well, we were actually looking at getting it licensed. At one stage, Positiva contacted us and said we want to release it. So for just a little while there, we were pretty excited about it getting released. But then word came back that Kate Bush really didn't like it. So if Kate doesn't like it, it's not going to happen.
That is just...
But you still have the data, right? Like the dad and all and everything. So it could be like...
I actually do have the original file. And I did do an update like in 2007. I put this like acid line in it and stuff. 2011 I did it, sorry. Yeah, 2011. But no, I mean, I could probably, you know, make a better mix of it. maybe I should. Yeah. I think there was some...
Everybody leave in the comments. Is Jamie should do the remix, man, and release the original one in Bandcamp. Just release it in Bandcamp. It's amazing.
Yeah. I probably could just give it away. Yeah. But I mean, I could redo it, but I think there were some plugins that gave it that particular sound. Just the way the delays worked and the way the reverbs worked that I can't access anymore because they're such old plugins. So I tried loading it up and it just didn't feel the same. But I didn't
try that
hard.
The spirit of the track that it was created in, right. That makes it magic, bro. It's like building a computer in the garage. It's just like, it's just like that. Dude, that's such a cool story. Cause I was on YouTube, like, that was kind of, that remix was like, dude, I've only been listening to progressive music for like a little over 2 years. And that remix, it perfectly coincided with Stranger Things coming out, this project for me. So I was like playing, bro, it has hella plays. It's like 200,000 on YouTube. I was like, holy shit. This is crazy.
There would have been a lot of 12 inches pressed. So many people I know have that 12 inch.
Dude, so looking back on it, we're what, 20 years later or something?
Yeah.
Are you stoked that it got put out there or are you still bitter? Are you bitter? Not still bitter. Chill. I don't know. That's awesome.
I mean, it's a bootleg. I mean, if it was one of our original tracks,
right.
And somehow something that we never released that someone, you know, pressed and, you know, sold like 30,000 copies and they made the money from it, then yeah, that would hurt because it was our, but because this is just something that was fun to make a remix of someone else's tune, I'm not going to stake claim to it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I have a question because right around this time, you're a musical guy, technical guy. How was the transition from analog to digital for you? And Ruben, we can go back if I missed any glaring other tracks that we need the stories of. But I was just curious. I was just curious in this question.
It is an amazing thing to see that transition because for most producers, it's not an easy transition.
It's funny because I had this conversation on Saturday night when I was out. I was speaking to someone. They actually asked exactly the same question. I've never been asked that before. And then this twice in a few days. but I guess to be honest, because it was in real time as the technology was coming through, it's not like I had to go, how do I do this? Like it was... The technology slowly became better and slowly became better and better. Back in late 90s, I was kind of PC based using Cubase, I think we were using. Using all hardware, recording down to DAT. And then I changed over to Logic when Adam Freeland came over to Australia and we helped produce his album. So we had that connection there. And he said, you know how to use Logic? Yeah. I'm like, yeah, of course. They go and buy it and figure it out. yeah, of course I know.
Yeah, of course.
which reminds me of that, you know, we were just talking about early before we started recording about the Industrial Light and Magic documentary.
Yeah.
Oh, you know how to do that, don't you? Yeah, of course. Like, trying to figure out how to do it.
Fake it till you make it, literally.
Totally. So it can't be that different, which it wasn't. So Logic then started getting more and more advanced and suddenly people were starting to record audio into it. And I guess as the technology sort of sounded better and better as it went along, we kind of sort of adapted it more and more. It's not like we kind of suddenly jumped ship and went, okay, let's just stop using the keyboards and we'll just go completely digital. It wasn't really like that. It was just, we just kept on using it as it made sense, really. And and I guess I went to fully digital, I think probably mid-2000s, we were pretty mostly digital, apart from, I guess, having said that though, Frank used to put a lot of the tracks together for our live shows, where he did a lot of the sound design, where he would just get his synths, record in some noises, like from the Nord, like this Nord lead, and a couple of other analog synths, and then chop them up and make little crazy noises out of them, and make, you know, sort of make grooves out of them. And it's funny, I don't know, I don't know if we ever said this before, maybe, I don't know. But so Frank would come together with, this is the beauty of playing live and not having any arrangements in place, is that all you needed to do was get like a couple of bars, between 2 and 4 bars of a piece of music and enough variations to make it interesting. So Frank would come up with a few of these each gig, and we'd be playing, and something would come in, like, oh, what's this? Yeah, mate, last night. Okay, cool. And we'd just be playing along. Okay. And Manny would like figure out what key it's in. He'd start like, oh, playing on his vocoder and say, yeah, keep doing that. That sounds good. Yeah, keep doing that. Like,
so yeah, that's awesome.
It would be these new sounds that would just come through. Like, Frank was amazing like that. He'd just come up with these great grooves, and we just jam and see what happened at that time. So
it's like jazz in time.
Yeah.
and improvisation.
Yeah. And most of the time we didn't know what track we're going to start with until we walked on stage.
Really? So you guys didn't have like anything planned? Like, let's just wing it. Let's see.
Yeah. The only time we started doing any kind of rehearsals, I guess, was when we started using a guitarist and a drummer, because they needed to know what was going on. When we started doing more song-based stuff, that's when we would do that.
Yeah, I have on that front, I have a quick question for you. If you could, just because I've been curious about this for years, and you kind of sound like not only like a big Underworld fan, but also someone who performs this kind of music live. How does it work? Like, especially in Underworld's archetype of like Mike, I think his name is Mike Smith.
Rick Smith.
Or Rick Smith. Sorry. Thank you very much. The singer, Carl Hyde and Darren Emerson. Like, What in a live act, a live electronic act like that, what is everyone doing and how does it come together? Especially like between the DJ and the sequencer or whatever Rick is doing. Like, blows my mind.
I've got only a limited knowledge of the way Underworld did their stuff. From my understanding, that they had like loops of things and they could bring in elements in and out depending on, you know, on the night. I think Darren had his own little setup that was synced that he could bring his parts in and out. That's my understanding. I don't know a lot about how their setup was. I know earlier on it was very much like the way we started. It was very, very much just fly by the seat of your pants, just putting loops in and just seeing what happened. They did that Soundfield gig. I don't know if you've read about this. One of their first gigs was this outdoor Soundfield event where they played for like hours and hours and hours. I think it was like one of those Spiral Tribe events. You know these ones?
The free sound system shit. Yeah.
So I think that was one of the first things they did before they did Dubno Bass. I think where Darren was part of this thing where they're trying to get into that space of working with this kind of music in this kind of environment and working on more hypnotic, you know, house-based, techno-based elements.
And how did you guys wing it? Like,
yeah,
and you go into the stage. Okay, so what are we going to do today? I don't know. Let's start with this one. Just like that. But how did you guys program that? Because it
Yeah. So I guess back to the what we each did, because it kind of feeds in to your question. I guess we had, okay, so back then Frank would have his MPC, and that was used as a sequencer where the 16 pads were mutes and unmutes, right? So you had the bottom left would be the kick, then there'd be the snare on the second pad, the closed hat, open hat, loop one, loop two, chords, and you'd have a couple of pages of these. So you could have possibly like 32 parts. And you could also have, you know, a variation of that to go over to a different sequence. And this would be, you know, like the, you know, maybe the main section of the track. You know, if it wasn't just a completely loop-based track, you could have another section of that. So as far as, so that, they'd be maybe two or four bars for each sequence. And so you'd have, you know, so maybe he would set up so that starts off with a loop on. And then it was up to him to when those elements came in and out. All those parts were going, individual outputs were going into a 32 channel, 20, it depends on which era we're talking, but mostly a 24 to 32 channel mixer. And then I'd be mixing those parts. I'd have a channel for each sound, all going to different delays and effects. And I have those effects going to another return so I could do feedback dub delays. Here's MPC. I had a drum machine that was synchronized so I could bring in other drum loops and stuff as transition parts. Because back then, you if you went from one track to another, you would just jump to the next track. So we needed some way of transitioning. So I'd have the drum machine with different things I program. I have like the roll function on the snare, you know, do little snare rolls and things like that. I also had a CD player, a little CD Walkman of all these noises and stuff that we'd make in the studio, little like washes and sounds and stuff that I would have on one of the channels that I'd just fade in and out those parts. And then Manny would have his synth, and his voice would go through this TC Electronics. Well, back then, early on, it was just a vocoder, like his old Roland vocoder. But then we got this TC Electronics thing, which would kind of do some doubling and some delays and stuff. And he'd have like a little guitar pedal, like a delay guitar pedal as well, where he'd, you know, loop his vocal as well. And a little submixer as well, so he could like loop his synth sound as well. And then that would go into my mixer, and so I'd mix his stuff as well. So as far as what we were doing, so Frank would be controlling the arrangements, but it'd also be the how I'd mix. So I could then take the EQ of a particular sound and do like upper mid-range sweeps of, you know, just doing some almost like sounds like kind of filtering.
Like high pass, low pass, yeah, just cutting.
Yeah, and just go real this. And so because I'd be focusing on that sound for that particular moment, Frank would then know that that part is going to be the highlight for this particular moment, so he wouldn't bring anything else in at that time. Or if Manny was on this great roll with his singing, whatever he's doing there, or playing a keyboard part, I'd kind of bring out, I'd sort of fade down the other elements that might get in the way and let him do his thing. And we end up kind of having we just look at each other. Like I out of corner of my eye, I'd see that Frank was about to kind of bring in a sound. So I know that maybe I should bring in the wash there, bring in some white noise there to know, knowing.
So
that
you guys had like a very cool synchronicity there, just doing everything.
It sounds like a quarterback and his wide receivers, American football. It's like unspoken communication. Just
I know
like
nothing about
a
American
glance.
Football, but take your word for it.
So you were like the DJ in the whole thing. Like you're just DJing everything.
It's just like looking at each other. And the great thing about playing live is it's both a blessing and a curse, because you're responding to a crowd. So when when you got a moment and it works, you go, yeah, let's just keep riding this. Yeah, we can just keep on going with this. Let's push it further. Or if you go, yeah, it's not really kind of working, let's kind of just bring it down a bit and work on a groove a bit more. Or, you know, so those moments would be really special, but they're pretty much impossible to kind of play again. But also means that if the crowd isn't really with you, it's very, very hard to get something working, which we were pretty unprofessional in that way. Like, we probably should have had, you know, more rehearsals to know what to do when.
And what would work and what would not work.
This is what you're getting, guys. I hope you're liking it.
Yeah, they're not really reactive. You know, they're not really, you know, if they're not really responsive to what you're doing, it can be very hard to play. And I think I said this in the other interview, but it's just a funny story anyway. So, I think it was the first gig at Fabric, which we got, by the way, because when I was saying I worked with Adam Freeland on his album, he really liked what Infusion were doing live. And so he went back. He was a resident at Fabric at the time. So he went back to Fabric after he finished his sessions with us and told them, he said, you should book Infusion to play. And so that was our first international gig, was at Fabric. And we were shitting ourselves because we didn't know if there were, you know, 100 other bands that were playing the same way. And we were just, you know, some kind of small fish that didn't really know what they were doing from the arse end of the world. So we didn't know how it stacked up because our experience was only within Australia. So like, oh, you know, Fabric, like the one of the biggest, you know, most respected clubs in the world.
In the world, yeah.
Who knows what with this crowd has seen before. This could be like, oh my God, he's so 10 years ago. So so we got up there and we started playing. It was great. But there was this one guy in the middle of the crowd, like watching us going like, and I could not stop looking at him. And I'm playing like, why isn't he dancing? Why isn't he dancing? And kept on playing and playing. And I just, yeah, just had to push a little bit further. Like, ugh. So yeah, it was a really good gig, but he just, just something about this was just disturbing me. Like, what are we doing wrong? It's so funny like that, right? Anyway, so we finished playing and we went upstairs to the bar area up the top of the club. And this guy came up to me. And I was like, oh no, here we go. Yes.
Here it comes.
Yes. What the fuck was that? He said, I'd never seen anything like that in my life. That was insane. I said, I just couldn't stop watching you. Like, dude, I thought you hated it. He said, no, I was just mesmerized. I'm like,
he was like, no, paralyzed.
Don't pay attention to the guy folding their hands in the middle of the dance floor.
He was in a state of shock. I've had that feeling before. Yeah.
He's like with his arms crossed.
I was trying to figure out what you guys were doing.
Well, that's the magic of it for me. That's why it will always be like wizards up there, especially when it gets into the live performance stuff, just because it's just like, I can't get past how are they doing this? So thank you for telling us a little bit about it.
I have a feeling that most people would have known how live that was. I think for the majority of the time, back then, people thought we were DJing. Like, for a lot of people, they don't really see the difference. And they don't, because it was relatively seamless, like, well, when it was good, it was pretty seamless. And I think that they just saw that. It was like you're playing your records. And they didn't know that if we just press play and let it go, you'd hear the same kick drum just go for hours until we press stop. Like, we were just doing it on the spot. And I think if YouTube had been the thing back then, where we could have done some videos, like just showing the fans and an audience of how we did what we did, I think it would have been a different. Oh, no, I wouldn't say it's a different response, but I think people would have been a bit surprised as to how live it was. But I think the reason why people did keep coming back to the shows because each time it was different and there was an energy there that could only be created from playing live. If we had like backing tracks or if we relied on we'll just play over the top of this, we would have got bored and it would have been predictable. And Manny got married a few months ago and I had not seen Frank for many years, actually. Because they both live in Sydney now. I live in Melbourne. And we haven't really kind of spoken that much at all, Frank and I. And so I saw him and it was really awesome just to catch up and talk about how different the scene is now. And we're saying, oh man, imagine if we were doing Infusion with Ableton now. I mean, which Manny and I actually did some shows a couple of years ago as Infusion, and we did using Ableton because it's a lot easier if we didn't have Frank because he didn't want to do it. So yeah, it makes a lot of difference. But yeah, I said to Frank, like, imagine if back then we were using Ableton. He said, we would have been bored. Like, he said, I think that was part of the excitement was like, what could go wrong? You know?
Definitely. You're like in the crossfire. Times, yeah.
My God, the number of times we got off, we went to go and set up at a venue and we did sound check. Number of times we turned on the MPC and it wouldn't turn on because somebody baggage handler had thrown the MPC off the baggage thing and things inside had broken or desoldered. Frank is an electronic engineer. So he would open it up, get the soldering iron out. So many gigs would have missed if he didn't know how to use a soldering iron.
Dude, that's insane.
Like every third or fourth gig would be opening up, like unscrewing it all, soldering it back on again, reseating the circuit boards because the baggage handlers had thrown stuff around.
When people are like, bring back analog or analog was better as an artist, you're probably like, you have no idea what we had to go through.
And our mixing desk is 32 kilograms.
Oh my God.
Oh man.
Like with the case, it was right on the upper end of what you could take on a plane and lugging that around with the MPC, with all this. And nowadays you just get like a little controller, laptop, you know, Many could have his keyboard controller and microphone.
A MIDI keyboard, that's it.
So much easier. Anyway, yes.
Wow.
So what did you transition to making the, like all these tracks like solo? Like okay, I'm gonna go my own route.
Well, like I said, I mean, we ended up just slowing down on the Infusion stuff. It's funny because we started, like I said, in 1994. But things didn't really take off until we started playing overseas in like 2001. So we spent a long time before then playing. Then when we were touring, we didn't have a tour manager. And we had an amazing manager, but we didn't have a tour manager. We were just three of us. We lived in the same house when we came back from touring. We all lived in the same house. The studio is in the same house. So we all lived in each other's pockets, basically, for many years. And so when it all took off, in 2001, 2002, 2003, it became massive around 2005, 2006. By the time like 2008, we were pretty exhausted. We were just, I don't think we had any energy left, I think. So things just naturally just slowed down for us. I think around the time that, you know, the new audience was saying, guys, like, bring something new. I'm like, I don't know if we can. So basically stopped doing that. But I'd always been, you know, doing my little bits of music whilst Infusion was going anyway. So for me, it wasn't really a matter of trying something new for myself. It was just I wouldn't have other people involved in what I was making, which, you know, what makes collaboration amazing is you do things that you wouldn't be able to do yourself and you know, bit greater than some of its parts. That's the whole kind of excitement about collaboration. But the other side is you could just see things through on your own in your own way. So I did, like I said, I mean, back in the early 90s, I did a couple of things by myself as well. But then my first release as Jamie Stibbs, I think it was on Luke Recordings, the LOOQ. I think Momu did a remix. So Luke being a label out of San Fran, I believe.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's called The Night Before. I think that was my first solo release.
Oh, this card says it is, yeah.
Oh, right.
Oh, okay. Nice group, yeah. Yeah.
When in doubt. yeah. So that was my first release. And then, yeah, I don't know. I started doing some remixes for people. And like, for me, it was just, I didn't want to stop making music. Like, right. And Again, something I was talking to another friend about on Saturday night. I was talking to Casey about this, actually. He was there on Saturday as well. And we're talking about how just music making is just such an obsession. It is literally an obsession. Like, you know, I think about what I'm going to make the next day. I constantly trying new things, reading new things. I'm just absorbing everything. So for me, it was just a continuation of music making, just making it under my own name, really. And also when not doing the live thing, I then found time to explore the DJing side of things as well. Because that interaction with the crowd, that, you know, it's such a different process, a creative process than in the studio, which is also why the Infusion thing was kind of weird as well, because, you know, go back to Infusion, but it's, what's interesting about that is because the live jamming thing was so different to what you do in the studio. When in the studio, it's much more a kind of a scalpel kind of approach, you know,
right.
Whereas the live thing is the kind of just warts and all, mistakes happen. In the studio, you don't want that. You know, it's a very different kind of experience.
Totally. Yeah, no, you can't.
So that's why the recorded stuff sometimes isn't really like the live shows at all, because we found it hard to kind of translate that energy into the studio. But for me, the DJing thing was the next best thing to get that energy, that excitement with working to engage an audience. So I loved that. And I've since kind of done my own live shows as well, because I just love that feedback, that connection you have with people, taking them somewhere, you know. And that's why I got into this kind of stuff to begin with.
Very cool. You
know? It must have felt,
and you're taking out amazing music.
Yeah, it must have felt fresh for you to be able to like take a new approach to this industry that you've already steeped yourself in. That must have been cool, bro.
Yeah, yeah. It took a while, I think, to kind of find my feet with what I wanted to do. And then, yeah, it was, I kind of over time kind of found my own, I guess, musical voice, my own production voice over that time, where it wasn't so connected with the other two.
Yeah.
So I guess I really spent a lot of time just kind of finding out who I am as an artist.
Great producer, man. Yeah, yeah. You're making great music. Like, he's everywhere. Like, Suit Beat with Guy J, Balance Records, like everywhere.
All on Celador. I see everything coming through. I'm like, well, let's go.
Yeah.
Very, very good sound.
Yeah.
Amazing sound.
Honestly, I think I do understand how lucky I am that I'm able to do it with labels and people and be supported by such incredible artists. That, you know, I know that's not something to be, you know, sneezed at. That I know that's not an easy thing to happen. And I know that a large part of that is because of where I've come from, that I formed a connection with these people. So they've known my music for a while. So I know that I've been able to utilize that in that I didn't have to build those relationships from the start to get them to hear what I was making. And secondly, I'm stupidly lucky that I'm still ridiculously inspired. You know, I'm still really, really excited about getting in the studio and making stuff. I know a lot of people do struggle, and I definitely have struggled with waves of inspiration. Yeah, it's natural. But I think, we were talking before about, you know, that I teach, and I think that has gone a long way towards helping me find or connect with my processes and what I do, and opening myself up to different ways of working. Because when you're forced to, when you have to teach someone how to make music, you have to understand it yourself. And so when most of the time you do stuff intuitively, you just do stuff that makes sense to you. You don't have to really think about it.
Yeah, but tell us, where are you teaching? Do you have like an academy? Do you have courses? Do you have a platform? And what are you teaching this?
So I've been doing one-on-one teaching for many, many years now, where I show people different approaches to making music. what I like about the one-on-one sessions is that, well, they came about because I had people coming up to me at gigs saying, I really love to know how you make your music. Like, I don't know how you do it. And so I tried telling them how I did it. And then I was like, no, well, actually, I should find out what you want to know specifically. Like, what are you lacking in your productions? Like, what do you feel like you'd get the most out of? Like, I could teach you. So it was born out of that, just people coming up to me and asking me how I make music as well. Like, let me help you, you know, find your own artistic voice in that way. So that kind of grew out of that. And then just lately, I have started teaching at a place called CollArts here in Melbourne, which is a university here that teaches like a range of artistic endeavors, like, you know, anything from fashion to design to audio engineering to music production. And so I work in the music production area, and I teach a unit called Producing Different Styles. So I teach people how to make different types of music, like for anything. Like I've had my students go from like 90s throwback indie rock to trap to metal to Ben Sims techno to everything.
Hey, so nice.
we look at dissecting a whole range of different styles of music, everything. Go, okay, what makes them tick? What makes them work? Why does that work? Why is it an arrangement of this song? Why wouldn't it work in this kind of genre? What makes it, you know, what's the sound palettes of these things? And once you kind of deep dive into these sorts of things and understand what makes things tick, you can then take these things and, you know, help them, have them help you find your own way of expressing yourself, rather than kind of keeping within your own lane, I think. And that's what I've always found really exciting. You know, we're talking about like listening to a whole range of music, being inspired by all types of music. I think since I've been doing stuff on my own, I've really spent a lot of time really going into the music that I love and trying to understand what it is that I love about it. I don't know if that's because I have some kind of condition. do I really want to ruin the music? But yeah. But I'm just genuinely so, so hugely interested in about what makes things tick. And that goes for everything. Like, culture, politics, everything. I want to know kind of how things work.
Jamie, your music has always been part of my set. I have a podcast. I have a podcast called Linear, and I'm always playing like a remix of yours or anything.
So great.
I'm in there. I'm signed in, dude. The sound is cool. Amazing.
I think it's cool with the teaching, bro, that like... And we have one more question for you. Thank you for sticking with us for so long. This is like one of those classic, we're going to go from A to Z. But I think with the teaching, it's like, okay, you're a musician. All your life, you've had these instincts of why you like things the way you do or why you like these sounds. And teaching kind of allows you to actually discover these things about yourself. It's like looking at a mirror and the end result of that is a student is being taught something new. Like, what an awesome thing that's the product of you looking at what you've done and saying, this is why this works for me. And the result of that is somebody else gets to go out and make some new music. It's great.
Yeah. It's an amazing feeling. There's been some students that I've had, I call arts, where, you know, I can see the way they've developed through them opening their eyes to different styles of music, to showing them creative ways of harnessing different things that they emotionally connect to. Cause I think that's the biggest thing. It's not just throwing a net out there and like, oh, try a bit of this, try a bit of that, which is fun. But okay, what is it that's really kind of speaking to me? What is it that I'm emotionally connecting to? And once you understand that, then I think you can start playing with these things that are more connected to who you are. I think that's the most important thing when you're making music. It's got to be honest, you know. I think if you're going to have any kind of longevity, or more importantly, I think if people are really going to connect with your music, it has to come from a really good place. You know, it has to, I think people can pick up on inauthenticity. inauthentic. I think they can sense that, you know, for particularly for the type of music we're talking about. I mean, I know there's different music that works at different levels. Okay. So, you know, yes, you can have, you know, like a very finely crafted pop song. But I think even at those levels, I think the people who write those melodies come from a really good place as well. But I think when you're talking about the music that we make and a huge other broad range of music genres as well, the people who are passionate about music, that really listen to music as a way of life, they're the ones that can really pick up on it. Yeah, it's not quite doing it for me.
That doesn't communicate what something.
Yeah. So I think it's got to come from a really genuine place for it to work.
Yeah, at the end of the day, everything that all of music producers do is just try to communicate their sound, their heart, what they have in their mind, what is like just haunting you in your head that you just got to get out there. Like what you said, like that inspiration, that thing.
Yeah.
Every day you're looking for that sound.
Yeah. Not even trying to get out something. It's about discovering something. Yeah, because a lot of music production is about the discovery, you know. But with electronic music in particular, where you're playing with sound, you know, when you're using your intuition, you're playing with something. There's something about this. I'm going to follow this. You follow things to a place. You get people talking about a flow state, where you're not. You know, this is why it's really important to really know your tools really, really well. So you don't have to think about how you go about making something. You kind of use your tools and you start on the journey with something and you go, okay, I can take it down this path. Okay, what if I add this and this? And that can happen really quickly. And when you're not overthinking it, that's, I think for me, that's when it becomes really authentic, because you're not trying to impose something on it. You're taking something where it's leading you. Really, and I found that where the tracks that I'm the most proud of, the ones that I connect with the most, are the ones that have happened quickly, and where I feel like I have not had the most involvement in a weird way. Yeah. You know, like we've got into that. So, and I've spoken to other people about this as well, other producers. And it's the tracks you think back, and people say, "How did you make that?" And you go, "No, I actually don't know. I actually can't remember. I can't actually remember. You get into this state. You act by intuition. And you know, I know I was talking about like really kind of, you know, grassroots understanding something and getting to the real kind of fundamentals of things to really understand it. That's one thing. Okay, that's one process. That you're not thinking about that when you're making music. Right. That then goes into the back here. Mm-hmm. It sits here and helps informs those decisions you make when you're going down a path of, you know, creative discovery of something. It's, you know, that helps, you know, helps make those decisions for you when you're doing that. It's not really at the forefront of your mind. Otherwise that would get in the way and you'd start overanalyzing and you'd lose it. So,
dude, this is speaking to me so clearly. I am in the biggest Bruce Lee phase that I never thought I'd be in. But right. Bro, the way he talks about martial arts is, there can't be a moment of thinking. You have to train and train and train, as you say, know your tools so that your reaction is an authentic form of self-expression.
100%.
Yeah, dude, it's so cool that I'm always looking for these parallels between like something else out in the world and this music, bro. And you're just like painting the perfect picture. Exactly.
I'm always doing this one in my class. I'm always using metaphors. I'm like,
yeah.
And because I went to university, I did fine arts. And so the parallels with art and all forms of art are pretty, you know, pretty obvious, really. Oh. You know, then you talk about tone and rhythm and color, like, and the disciplines are all the same as well. You know, when you work on something, you know, there's a process of replication where you learn tools by replicating something, and then you learn your own voice, you discover your own voice by just repeatedly working on something. Just keep doing it until it becomes, you know, intuitive. You know, where, like you said, like
natural,
learning your tools, like, you know, finding those things that speak to you, just by just making a whole series of works. You think about painters who sit in a studio painting that one thing. There's something about that, and they'll make, like, you know, 50, 100 of these paintings, and each one gets closer and closer to who they are. And I think that, you know, when you're producing music, it can be the same thing. People get, unfortunately, this kind of idea that their very first piece of music they're going to make, they need to perfect that, and that's what they're going to put out there. It's like, no, make another 100 of those, and then that's going to be a lot more authentic. You're going to learn so much more. Don't try and... I know, and I'm speaking from experience because I was like that too. I always thought
totally. That first, and I think that can be misconceived or a misperception, because it's not saying like you're not good enough. It's saying you're going to be capable of so much more and know yourself so much more that 100th, if you go into the studio after that 100th time, you're just going to be, it's just going to be truer to you as an artist.
That is exactly it.
Well, I think, so how we like to conclude these interviews, and bro, been waiting to ask you this question since we started sharing these stories. Mm. But we like to kind of wrap this up with, I went into this project super progressive, thinking progressive house was a genre of music. In some ways it is. But every interview, I'm taught more and more that progressive is more a mindset towards the world of music. We like to ask our guest as a final question, what does progressive mean to you?
I think that pretty much sums up there. It is very much, I mean, the music that I was drawn to that was labeled progressive was this idea that anything was possible in that kind of frame, you know, that it was a place where you could experiment. I mean, it wasn't experimental music, but it was, they told a story. And for me, progressive is that mentality of wanting to tell a story of sharing the highs and lows. And for me, progressive is that the long form idea of emotional storytelling through sound, I think. And I think that speaks to the kind of progressive DJing style as well. I think it's funny because it's obviously the word progressive is, as you know, has kind of gone through many kind of permutations. But I guess, yeah, for me, when I think about what it is, the part of progressive that I've really kind of connected to, which I think in some ways, there's a lot of progressive music out there that I feel like kind of loses what it is about. With all, like, same with all genres are like this. There's always going to be music that, you know, that plays with an idea that doesn't get to the root of what the true essence is. And that's only a small number, but I think for me it is about the emotional storytelling. I think over one track. Or an entire six hour set.
Totally, man. Well, thank you for that, Ruben. Do you have any final questions?
No. I think I'm all set. That the whole broad stroke of all the things that Jamie has taught is amazing. Like the professor talking about like all these amazing things through his life and what he's learned and what he teaches now and of course, everything just reflects directly on his passion and his work. So it's all there. As always, guys, like I always say at the end of this, please leave your comments. Help us grow this community. And remember to share, like, hit the bell, everything. And Jamie, thank you very much for this. It's been an amazing journey. Thank you for your words. Thank you for your music. And please keep on doing it. It's amazing, man. I'm there.
I had an absolute ball change to you guys. So thanks so very much for letting me talk.
No, it's great, bro.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, wonderful question. So yeah, what's really awesome is just how enthusiastic and passionate and knowledgeable you guys are. It's fantastic. So yeah, keep doing it.
Yeah, thank you, bro. Ruben, you got to say your phrase so we can leave.
Yeah, of course, man. Remember, guys, and Jamie, hey, stay true, stay progressive.
There you go. Thank you so much, Jamie. Keep it real, bro.
Keep it real. Have a great night. Thank you, guys.
Cheers, guys.
Bye. Super progressive.